Welcome back, everybody. I'm excited for today's talk, for today's guest. I'm joined by Mr. Ian Davis, the Disillusioned Substack blogger. And we're going to talk about a topic that's going to depress everybody. Everyone's already depressed. We're going to make it worse. We're going to talk about multipolarity. We're going to talk about BRICS. We're going to talk about the New World Order with this new emerging paradigm and how it's all a psyop, how it's all fake, how it's all bad, and none of it's any good. It's going to be the most depressing talk to date, I'm sure. But I'm joined by the very upbeat Mr. Ian Davis. So welcome, sir. Thank you for talking to me. Can you explain to me what all this multi-whatever is? Because that's all I hear about nowadays. And I feel like I have no clue what it really is. It's out of my area of expertise, kind of your wheelhouse. What do you think, sir?
Well, thanks very much for inviting me, Rory. It's nice to be here and chatting with you because I've been reading your work for a while. So you've been giving me a valuable perspective on Ukraine and everything Russian related. So it's nice to be able to chat to you.
For sure.
Multipolarity, really, I mean, what it essentially boils down to. It essentially boils down to global governance with teeth. So if you think about the current, some people call it the international rules-based order, the Western-centric, Western empirical, unipolar model of, you know, basically global geopolitical centralized governance through the auspices of the UN, dominated and controlled by the US and its allies. And although, you know, I would argue that that's never been quite true because, you know, all power really at the United Nations resides in the Security Council. And obviously Russia and China have got veto in there as well. So it's not as if the West can just simply do whatever it wants in terms of the Security Council. But as we're, you know, and as you often write about, and as is, you know, as a lot of people have observed, there isn't any such thing really as any kind of international order. It's currently might is right. The US and its allies have been for many, many decades now striding around the world, causing wars, being violent, oppressing other countries, blowing up weaker nations and asserting their will on everybody. Everybody's fed up with it. And the whole world is now united against that. So we are told. So I think that's very clear what we're seeing in the Middle East at the moment. You know, everyone is realized that the international rules-based order as it was, and interestingly enough, even Rothschild-backed think tanks like the Lowy Institute are now openly talking about the end of the international rules-based order and how we need a new global order, blah, blah, blah. So then comes in, what is the alternative? So the alternative on the table, we can see that articulated most clearly, perhaps, in the joint statement of President Putin and President Xi about 3 weeks before the launch of Russia's entry into the war in the Donbass, you know, which obviously started 8 years earlier. In that statement, they talked about this concept of multipolarity. And what they were suggesting actually was a more multilateral form of global governance. So there's a difference between multipolarity and multilateralism. Multipolarity is the idea of the world being broken up into smaller regional poles. So we might think of in terms of, for example, Pax Americana, Pax Eurasia, maybe you know, Pax Africa, you know, that kind of idea of breaking it up into smaller regional blocks, and that would be administered at a global, centralized global level through the United Nations. But what's key to this is, and this is the argument very much put forward by the advocates of multipolarity, led by most notably perhaps Russia and China, that system would be more multilateral. And what that means is more nations having more of a say in global decision making. So ostensibly, on the surface, you know, a lot of people might think that, well, that sounds like a reasonable idea. I mean, you know, why should we have to suffer? And why should people like the Palestinians have to suffer, you know, a US-backed far-right Israeli government blowing them up? You know, that would be something that a lot of people would get on board with. And it has to be said, a lot of people are on board with it. A lot of people are very much supportive of that idea.
Yes, my blog supports Israel's right to do whatever they want. How dare you, sir? They are chosen by God, and I'll let you know, sir, that you are not allowed to make fun of them for that. But yes, you know, you had a great article about Hamas, which I hadn't written an article about. It's not my wheelhouse, not my forte. But I also knew that Hamas was a concoction. It was a false front. It was designed by the Palestinians' enemies. And you got into that. And so you have a suspicious mind going into this, exploring these topics. Can I simplify, perhaps, this is, maybe you can tell me if I'm on the right track or not with this multipolarity thing. It's almost like they're saying there are regions of the world that global governance is not firmly solidified yet. And what we're going to do is we're going to reach those regions by relying on these blocks, like these nodes of power. And so actually what we're doing was we're building globalism better and so in the sense that they're saying, like, let's give other countries or other poles more autonomy or more of a say. What they're actually saying is that let's bring in place that more of the world, let's create this grid of control even tighter than it was before. Like, you know, let Moscow handle this area for you, and they'll be able to globally integrate it better than if it was just you alone in Washington. That's sort of how I'm interpreting it. It's sort of like the Scottish independence movement, where they were saying, we want to be independent from the UK, but we want to join the EU and be more part of the global community. It's like that sort of thing. Is it really independence, or are you trying to attach yourself to a more, and even, you know, a bigger authority? Is that the kind of bait and switch that you're hinting at, or am I off mark? Tell me what you think.
No, that is the bait and switch that I'm hinting at. So firstly, the idea is there's a lot of talk about the global south. So the global south, you know, and that starts from India southwards, really. So, you know, northern India southwards, including Pakistan, that sometimes gets wrapped into the global south and so forth. The idea is that these nation states, you know, they're resource rich. That's true enough. But they don't have a voice on the global stage. And therefore that is allowing, under the current international rules-based order, there's a disparity there in geopolitical power, because the mighty United States is able to pretty much do whatever it wants, and everybody else is fed up with it. So how are we going to respond to this? The idea, the response is multipolarity, which means it also means breaking regions down into more regionalized supply chains as well. And this is an important concept within it. So the idea is that these poles will be more autonomous in terms of their supply chains. Now, this is where it gets confusing, because most people, the way it is being presented to us on as a surface narrative, is that this notion is being driven by the BRICS, the Global South, the governments of the Global South, led by, you know, a kind of united front being presented through by Russia and China, and certainly China as the economic powerhouse in that kind of alignment of forces, arguing for multipolarity and the important concept of multilateralism. So there'll be more. All multilateralism means is more involvement in decision making for all nations. So that's how it's presented to us. So it's like you've kind of got this decaying Western order, US led, NATO aligned, geopolitical and military behemoth on one side, and the rest of the world advocating multipolarity on the other side, saying, yeah, this isn't going to work. We need to think more rationally about how global governance is managed. So that's how it's presented to us. That is not what it actually means. For a start, multipolarity has been promoted by the West and many elements within what we might call the Western deep state, for example, such as that you can go back to groups like the Rhodes-Milner group that were talking about a three-power world in between the wars, you know, after the First World War. You've got the Rockefellers talking about a regionalized order under the auspices of the United Nations in the 1960s in what they called their special studies project. Well, they more or less outlined in its entirety the arguments that are now being presented as multipolarity, saying that this was their ambition. This is what these powerful financial institutions that they represent and private interests, this is what they were aiming for. We can then go forward to the Great Reset. And in the Great Reset, they talk about the breakdown of globalization, but they talk about the managed breakdown of globalization into regions, right? So they're talking about this, essentially the same idea as multipolarity, but not necessarily multilateralism. So what I am saying is, although on the surface we have been given what I would say is a false oppositional dialectic, in reality, what we are seeing is all sides aligning to create a multipolar-based model of global governance, because the actual objective is to create a system of firm global governance, which we don't have at this point. Hitherto, I think it's, you know, most people would be, you know, it was fair to say that the UN has never managed to achieve global governance. It doesn't actually rule nation states in the way that those that have supported it since its inception, which are often very powerful private institutions and private financiers, the bankers, they've envisaged a system where the UN would rule. So genuinely centralized global governance. And that is what is being delivered through multipolarity. So that is where we are heading. So what we're actually heading for is a system of centralized, real global governance, something much closer to a global government. That is what is actually happening. And the notion that the West is opposed to it, and the West and the East are somehow opposed in this scenario, isn't fully accurate. I would suggest that there are powerful forces on both sides that are jostling for position and advantage within this one cohesive, centralized system of global governance. But both sides, or multiple sides, are equally committed to creating that system.
Wow, that's very, very well said, very succinct, and it's eerily similar to, I sort of, I deal on a much more micro level. You're talking about bigger events, but that's the same conclusions I've come to about, say, the Russian elite vis-a-vis the Western elite. They want the same thing. They just want a seat at the table that's better than the one that they have right now. They want a bigger piece of the pie. They want more input in the global government of the future. And that's what they were promised with the collapse of the USSR. And they want what's due. And that's why they're basically playing hardball now. That's how I conceptualize this conflict and the so-called showdown with East and West. Now, are you saying, just to you said a lot of interesting stuff, just to, could you please fine tune this one point so that we can better understand? You're saying that there has to be a demolition of the current system, this so-called globalized world order, and a transition to these blocks. And this transition to these blocks is a step along the way towards even more centralized global government, correct?
Yes. Yeah. And I think
you explain that.
Yeah, so if we look at what they were talking about, I mean, this is happening. To what extent this is happening organically or not, I think is debatable. I mean, there is certainly, we've seen since the end of the Cold War and since the kind of breakdown of the kind of US's ability to manage a global empire more or less on its own, militarily, and extending to the South Pacific and extending to the Pacific and Asia and so forth. And we have seen the rise of, you know, as is we've seen many times before throughout history, that as you know, countries like Brazil, India, certainly if we look at India and China, that they have risen economically and geopolitically and even militarily as a result of the development that has happened in those countries. And even if we look in countries in Africa, for South Africa and Nigeria and countries like that, they have been advancing economically and developing. So as they are developing, obviously they seek a greater share of geopolitical influence on the global stage, which is only so to a great extent, that is a fairly organic and natural process. However, we can also see where that process has been advanced and pushed. Certainly, if we look at China, it is very difficult to see how China could have its economic progress could have its transformation could have happened as it did without significant amounts of foreign direct investment. And most of that has come from Wall Street and the West and the City of London and there are groups like the Trilateral Commission and so forth that were pushing this when China opened up in the late 70s with Kissinger's visit and, you know, that, and you know, Deng Xiaoping and people like that, that pushing forward the opening up of the Chinese economy. That was very much done in partnership with the West. And, you know, so now for, you know, we are 50 years further down the road and we get this rather childish and ridiculous narrative of supposed animosity between, you know, the US and China. A lot of the time, these tales are given to us, I think, to give us the proles something to believe in. You know, it's something like, you know, this is the narrative you're given to believe in. It's false, but just believe it because that suits our interests in terms of, you know, your own government's interests.
So I find that a lot of people want to believe it because it gives them hope or something. I find that when I try and explain to them that actually Kissinger is central to understanding Russia as well. He's the guy who tapped Putin to become the president of Russia. He was involved with basically the controlled demolition of the Soviet Union. There's a lot I could say about the relationship between the West and communism because the West was also investing and building up the Soviet Union in the early years. Why were they doing that? I think the answer on some level is that you have one force, political force, that goes into a country, wrecks it, reduces people to slaves, basically, to chattel, working for pittance, destroys their culture, forces them into barracks and mass factories and no regulations and just, you know. And then, so you have very cheap labor because of that. And so communism sort of paves the way for capitalism. We were told that capitalism paves the way for communism, but you know, it seems like capitalists seem to always want to invest into communist countries, and it's strange that, yeah, you're right, how is it that we're told that there was this, the Soviet Union and America were these diehard enemies, and yet American companies had built up the Soviet Union? It was a bunch of just straight up setting up factories, setting capital equipment, not even to mention the lend lease and the fact that they entirely propped up the war effort of the Soviet Union, and they continued to have most favored nation trade status, like all this stuff. There wasn't really any sign of this war, and then at the same time with China, we have the exact same story. All these American companies being chopped up and sent and shipped overboard overseas to China. And then we're told, oops, oh, actually, no, they're actually diabolical, Nazi, communist, whatever, bad everything. And we need to prepare for war to protect Taiwan from these monsters that we have spent the last 50 years. Doesn't make any sense. Doesn't add up. And that's all fascinating. And I'll ask you, you can pick that up as well again. But could we return to that question? I just really want to make sure I understand. So basically, to get from where we are now, what are the things that they do not like about the world as it is right now? What are the obstacles that they're trying to like overcome by creating these blocks to reach the ideal of the totally centralized government? It seems like the blocks are a necessary stepping stone to get there, right? Because the leader, the poles in the blocks, the like Moscow in its Eurasia block, or China in its East Asia block, or Oceania, whatever, like these regional HQs will probably have more direct control over their block, and they'll be able to more fully integrate their block. And then at some point, maybe 10, 20, 30 years down the line, these blocks will be able to be more easily integrated finally into the one center, one world government. Is that the thing? It's like a stepping stone. Am I reading it right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that basically it's important to recognize that there are people, a guy called David Rothkopf, who was a member of the Council of Foreign Relations, but also a kind of journalist and a writer and a researcher. He called this group of people the superclass, and he was being very generous to them by calling them the superclass. I call them the parasite class. But they are people who have, in his terms, have the ability to move millions, and he meant both money and people and resources, across borders. So individuals that have this power, this kind of level of financial, often economic, and nearly always political power, what we would sometimes call oligarchs, what Plato called oligarchs, these people have always existed. Now, they don't care, and this is something that is I think is important to grasp. They don't care about nation states. They certainly don't care about populations, and they don't care about countries. They're not interested in those concepts, other than their use in terms of serving their purposes. So if we look at what's happened in the West financially, the Western financial and monetary system, if we go back to 2008 with the quote unquote global financial collapse, basically that was the end of that system, in my view. It was a busted flush at that point. We only need to look at the current level of claimed global debt to global GDP. I mean, the global debt is orders of magnitude greater than the global GDP, which of course is a nonsensical and quite ridiculous proposition. That can only happen when we are living in a world that is controlled by usury, which it is. And these people are sitting atop that system. And I often talk about something called a global public-private partnership, which is what the UN was established as. Everyone thinks the UN was established as an intergovernmental organization, which it was, but it was also established in partnership with, for example, the Rockefellers. The Rockefellers were a massive part of the establishment of the United Nations, even down to donating the land that the building itself is on. They set up what is now called the Secretariat. The UN Secretariat was originally created and funded through the Rockefellers investment and the Carnegies, and the same people, you know, the same banking elite that, if you read Anthony Sutton, which I'm sure you have, given from what you were just talking about there, were instrumental in setting up the Soviet Union, and instrumental in supporting China's economic turnaround. So they use massive nation states as vehicles for their entrepreneurship and vehicles for their investments. Now, what happened in 2008 was that Ponzi scheme, the Western Ponzi scheme of just creating money from nothing and living off nothing but debt, which was a global system, was exposed. And it was clear that that cannot continue forever and ever and ever. It just simply can't. There's going to come a reckoning where it is clear that, you know, you cannot have a situation where the debts, the global debt, is 10, 12 times higher than global GDP. It's a ridiculous concept. So that international monetary and financial system had to change. It had to change. So we're currently heading towards a system of digital finance and digital money based upon a universal ledger, which will probably be controlled by someone like the Bank for International Settlement. Whether that will include a debt write-off or not, I don't know. But it's a restructuring of the global international monetary and financial system. And all players are on board with it. But in order to get to this unified system, the old monetary system needs to break down. And if the old monetary system breaks down, that means that everything that goes with it breaks down as well. So we're talking about the old geopolitical system, the old system of international rules and international finance. It all has to be restructured. But interestingly enough, they don't want, if you look at a document that the Chinese government put out, which is called Our Shared Futures, it's called Global Agreement for Our Shared Futures or something like that. They are very keen to stress that they're not talking about completely destroying the current system of global governance. They want to keep the UN. In fact, they want to empower the UN. They want to give the UN more power. But they are very clear that what they are seeking is one system. That they want one global system that all countries will comply with. Now, that is the dream. That is the absolute zenith of the dream as stated by organizations like, I keep returning to the Rockefellers, but because they've been so prominent in talking about it. But it is also, you know, the reason I talk about the global public-private partnership is because it is also the epitome of what Klaus Schwab was talking about in the 1970s, something called stakeholder capitalism, which some people call communism, funnily enough. But stakeholder capitalism is actually closer to fascism because it is an amalgam between the state and private finance and corporate interests.
Well, it's funny that you bring that up. I'm always struck by the fact that if we look past the labels, a lot of the end product looks the same. So, for example, let's look at the Soviet Union. This is just like my wheelhouse. This is my examples. But we see that a political elite came to power following a crisis and a revolution. And using their political powers, they made themselves the bosses of industries. And so you had a merger between private and the government. There was no private sector. It was all government owned. And then they had the 90s, and you had, in theory, laissez-faire free market capitalism just forced onto the country all at once. And the end result of that was these so-called private oligarchs, private businessmen with so much economic power and control that they then, you know, ran entire sections of the government where they had a bureau totally under their thumb, or they call. I argue to this day that Russia is an LLC, not a country, because these oligarchs basically call the shots. And what is good for these oligarchs is private bottom line interests is the state policy that Russia. That's the most consistent way to predict Russian state policy. Is it good for the politically in favor oligarchs or not? So it's almost like identical to what was in the Soviet Union, except the ideologies changed, the aesthetics have changed, but you still have this merger of state and private and business power. And in America, you know, they kind of, when they had to fight a war, World War I or World War II, what did they do? The state took over with FDR. They passed all these, you know, the state became this Leviathan. They took over all this industry. They started running the economy, directing money. And you had this, again, this merger between private and government where the line was blurred. They were calling the shots, but who was calling the shots of the government? We know that the government, the FDR, was actually a puppet of the same people that you're talking about now, the same names, the same organizations, they keep coming up again and again. So, you know, it, like, if you strip it of all the labels, the end goal is just like total power, like economic power translating into political power translating into economic power. Is that a good summary of it? How do you agree with that characterization? What do you think?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that characterization. I mean, you can go all the way back, and this is nothing new.
China too. Yeah.
And China too. Yeah, China too. Yeah, I mean you look at the irony that people talk about, you know, a lot of people say, isn't it amazing what the China has done, the Chinese government has done for its people in lifting 850 million people out of poverty? That, of course, that is, you know, that's a good thing that there is less poverty. But let's think about the starting position there. That was the end of Mao's tenure, where people were murdered in their millions, starved to death. For the sake of state policy ambitions. So it's not a good, it wasn't a very good starting position, and of course it is worthy that there is less absolute poverty now in China. But at the same time, wealth disparity in China is gone through the roof. China, the Central Committee and the Great Hall in China, and the, you know, the Communist Party, you know, legislator in China, out of any legislature in the world, has the highest proportion of billionaires anywhere. So people are talking about the idea that, you know, China is this kind of progressive example, which it is in many respects, but oligarch power in China, as exemplified probably with Xi Jinping's kind of alignment with the so-called princelings, is rife in China. But I often get slated for pointing this out because, you know, it's almost impossible as a Western commentator to say anything derogatory or not derogatory or to say anything critical of the Russian and Chinese governments. It's just, you just get shouted down for doing that. In fact, you don't really even get shouted down. It's just not talked about. It is verboten. You know, if you start pointing out that actually what we're looking at is a global system that isn't really controlled by governments, but where governments are partners with multinational corporations and certainly with enormous financial and banking in interests, you know, that's almost like a taboo subject to talk about that. Instead, we are constantly given these narratives about nation states competing, which they do. And this is where it gets difficult, because nation states do compete for influence, but they are all on board with one system. So if we think
about they're in the paradigm, it's like, yeah, you have different basketball teams that compete, but they're all playing basketball. None of them is trying to play hockey. Right.
Yeah.
That's one of them. And the thing, you are allowed to critique Russia and China, but you're only allowed to critique them for certain issues. So Russia for being mean to the gays, and China for being mean to the Uyghurs. So that's like, they have a pre-prepared, you can't point out, yeah, that this conflict is fake, or that the pre-planned conflict for 2025 allegedly with China over Taiwan is fake, and that you can't point out that Russian oligarchs, Chinese oligarchs, they all for some reason stash their ill-gotten gains in the West, and they send their kids to study in the West, and their kids live in the West. You're not allowed to do that. So it's
no, yeah, I would correct that. You can absolutely criticize Russia and China if in a very basic kind of child level of geopolitical analysis that says, you know, Russia are the baddies and China are the baddies and we're the goodies. I mean, that's the mainstream narrative. That's what we get from our mainstream media in the West. What I meant was, among the people that are a bit more open to the idea that perhaps Russia had some genuine concerns about NATO expansionism and so forth in Europe, and who don't just automatically point at China and say China are the bad guys, which is obviously what the US establishment would prefer. Among that group of people, call them what you want, the independent media or whatever, it is precisely what you've just said, appears to be the taboo topic that you can't speak about without being called a shill for Western Empire. You know,
actually,
I mean,
you've been called worse. May I bring up an article that was written about you in UK column? Riley forwarded it to me. Do you mind if I share? I think it's hilarious.
There's this
woman. What's her name? You know who I'm talking about. This woman.
I do.
Who attacked you? What's her name again?
I think it's Vanessa Bealey that's written that section. Yeah.
Yeah, Vanessa Bealey. So she says, and this is just proof of what you're saying, where if you point this stuff out, this is the kind of treatment that you get. You get a shill. I mean, a literal government-sponsored shill. She works for RT, and RT is a spook-run organization. And it's you can talk to former people who work there, or you could just use your brain and realize that, yes, that's how state propaganda works. That's how the media works. That's how things work in this world. But okay. She says, and she's like some sort of a communist. And have you, like, one of the things I always point out, you know, you're talking about how, look, these conflicts are fake, but I think we would both agree that the massacres are real. People are dying. People are suffering because of it. And all I'm saying, yeah, and I think you're saying, and what I'm saying, and what people like Riley are saying is, man, wouldn't it be nice if we had a little bit of peasant solidarity? You know, if like the average guy being conscripted to fight in this country against that country, you know, if we had a little bit more, like, you know, what are we really, if we understand that it's all fake, maybe we won't hate each other that much. You know, we're being fed this propaganda about the other people to justify these wars. That's nothing new. And you'd think that we kind of, after 100 years of learning about how this is done, studying history, we wouldn't get fooled every single time a new conflict comes about. But no, people are still falling for this stuff. People still getting agitated and thinking that they're for everything good against everything bad. So this is what Vanessa writes about you for bringing this stuff up. For Western-based writers and researchers, it is perhaps easier to engage with threats posed to their own lives and well-being and those of fellow Westerners. This is related to COVID. This might create a propensity to prioritize critique of the COVID-19 event. She writes so terribly. I mean, I'm like trying to figure out what she's saying. She's basically, I'll skip to the part. Basically, indeed, one could argue that there is a level of subliminal white supremacism in the argumentation that conflicts in Ukraine and Palestine or the wider West Asia region are little more than distractions that will facilitate a dystopian governance regime. So you're a white supremacist if you point out, hey, these globalists seem to have a lot in common and these wars seem kind of fake. You're a Nazi globalist. You're a Nazi white supremacist. What else? Gayophobe, Uyghurphobe. I don't know. Like, this is, you know, so you've obviously gotten in trouble for pointing this out. But in general, are people receptive to your message? Or is it just the same treatment that I get when I try and talk about Russia? Just total blackout and total attacks on your character. What's been the response to what you've been saying so far?
Well, I think it highlights that there is a difference of opinion there. And I mean, with regard to Vanessa Bealey, I would say that, you know, she's done some excellent work in places like Syria. And, you know, for many years, I mean, she was reporting things in the Syrian conflict that, you know, she highlighted, for example, the issue of the white helmets and so forth like that. So she's done some groundbreaking work and she's, you know, generally, she's been a writer that I've always quite respected and a researcher that I've quite respected. But on this issue, yeah, you're absolutely right. Our argument is being characterized in this instance as coming from a position of white supremacy, which as a former kind of union steward and leftist activist who's moved towards a more of a voluntarist perspective, I find that utterly ridiculous, and it's almost tantamount to saying if you don't accept our analysis of the situation, you're a Nazi, which is one of the most ridiculous, basic, stupid arguments anyone could possibly ever make.
Everyone I don't like is Hitler.
Everyone I don't like is Hitler. Yeah. Yeah, and the point is, going back to what you were saying, our point is exactly what you said. We are being manipulated. We, the people of this earth, including, sadly, people like the Palestinians who are actually being slaughtered, people in Ukraine that have been killed, people in the Donbass that have been killed. You know, this is going on. This is happening. Nobody is saying that pointing out the fact that we are being manipulated in any way detracts from the loss of human life, because we are arguing that the people that are behind this don't care about human life. They couldn't care less about human life. I mean, if you actually start getting deep into the weeds of this stuff, there's a very strong strain of eugenics that runs through what Rothkopf called the superclass. Now, you know, which is tantamount, that is tantamount to, you know, if we go back to Galton and so forth, you know, then you could argue that really is white supremacy stuff. But the point is that no one is trying to suggest for one moment that people like the Palestinians don't deserve peace and any less than or any more than any of the rest of us deserve peace and prosperity and the ability to live our lives together and for our families to flourish and for our children to grow up and benefit from a stable and peaceful life. You know, we all deserve that. We human beings, we deserve it. There's 8 billion of us, and we deserve to be able to live peaceful lives. How many people would, you know, if you, you know, recently the government, the UK government have been, I mean, this is a complete load of rubbish, to be honest, but the UK government has been suggesting that the British people might volunteer to join the army to go and fight Russia, right?
I saw that.
I mean, right. So this is obviously, I mean, it's not serious. The army, for a start, the army hasn't got the British army has got absolutely no prospect whatsoever of launching any kind of meaningful military campaign against Russia. The idea is utterly ridiculous. So this is pure propaganda. They're just trying to get people to consider the Russian government and the Russian people, more to the point, as quote unquote the enemy. And our whole point is that the Russian people are not our enemy. The Chinese people are not our enemy. We're not their enemy. The only people that wants us to believe this are the people who are manipulating us. They want us to believe that we are each other's enemy, and we are not. If you've ever traveled, I don't know how many people have traveled, you know, to other parts of the world where, you know, people live in, you know, situations where poverty is rife and circumstances are difficult. The kind of people that we are told in the West are tantamount to being terrorists. Wherever you go in the world, wherever you meet other people in the world, you always find a welcome. You always find people that are willing to talk, that are willing to exchange ideas. There is no animosity between human beings. All things that all these paradigms are created to divide us, to conquer us, to separate us. And all we are saying is that paradigm doesn't stop at the geopolitical nation state level. In fact, if anything, it gets worse at the geopolitical nation state level. And we are given all these bogeymen to believe in, whereas in reality, what we should all be doing is seeking to as you said, to get beyond these ridiculous stories that we are told and realize that we are being manipulated, and then take steps ourselves as individuals and as local communities to turn our backs on these ridiculous fairy tales that we are given and to create a better world. And the only people that are going to do that is us, the people. We're the only ones that are going to do that, because sure as hell, the people that are trying to manipulate us have got no interest whatsoever in us being able to live better lives. Quite the opposite. Interesting.
I've traveled, I think at this point, to 60 countries, and I'll probably have to keep doing that for a while because I keep getting kicked out of countries like Ukraine, Russia, Belarus. And anyway, but the thing I've noticed is that in these countries, you're right, especially in these so-called, some of these poorer places, actually it's quite cozy. And the people, not all, I'm going to be honest, in some places, like in most parts of India, not a good place to be traveling alone. But for the most part, you do have this, yeah, this friendliness, this thing. And but when you get back to the West or to Moscow, you realize that they all these people have been plucked out of their environment. They've been thrown into cities like all over North America. They've been specifically mixed up to create, you know, proximity plus diversity equals conflict. And so paradoxically, like, if you live in America, you know, you may have a bad experience of people from like X country or whatever who've come over and they've carved out a ghetto for themselves and they're very hostile to the natives. But if you actually go to their country, you'll find that it's like it's totally different. Like the people are actually much nicer. They're very you're like, how is it possible that's and so on some level, I see social engineering at work here. I see, just like you said, this agenda to create these conflicts. And I see it so, I think we all see it so deliberately with like, COVID's a great example, right? I keep coming back to COVID. But they literally said that the people who refuse to get vaxxed or refuse to mask up, you know, that they're public enemy number one. And Riley gets into a lot of trouble for pointing out that, yeah, Moscow did that too. Like parts of Russia did that too. And they did it very enthusiastically. And people like who you know, live in, like that woman, she lives, I think, in Moscow. People who actually lived through the lockdowns, who, I mean, you had to be blind. Like you couldn't leave your apartment for 2 weeks, right? The cops were arresting people who went outside. You had to have passes to go into certain sections of the city. You couldn't go 1,000 meters outside of your region, out of your 15-minute region to get food and come back. Like that's how it was. Everything was shut down, and they will look you in the face and they will tell you there were no shutdowns in Russia. You know, there were no shutdowns. There was no mutiny. There is no war. It's just an SMO. It's insane. And you know, most of the people I'm talking about are paid to lie. But on some level, you talk to the average Russian and they'll be like, yeah, there were lockdowns. Of course there are. But these people who are paid to lie, they will deny it, and they will shame Riley. They'll blacklist him. Me, I'm so over the top that they just pretend I don't exist. But with him, they really went to town on him. So, yeah, I see a concerted effort to foster these divisions, create situations of conflict, of breaking up community, throwing mismatched people together, setting people against one another. All of it's social engineering. Can you tell me, just to get back on track, I could rant about this forever. But could you tell me what are the, so we've seen some of the social engineering stuff that's being advertised, like the medical tyranny, right? What other social engineering are they going to unleash as they implement their block program? So what else do they have in mind? Maybe, I know they have 15-minute cities in mind. They have the cattle tags, digital ID, the currency. What else? What am I missing here? What's the big one?
I think those, you know, these are the pillars of what is being rolled out globally. And when we say that, I mean, the analogy that I use, I would say, with nation states is, if you imagine a corporation, right? You've got one corporation, everybody's boat floats equally with the success of the corporation. And in this analogy, that corporation, we can call that global governance. Every country, you know, maybe sitting at the boardroom level, are all on board with the success of the project. The project is what matters, because as the project rises, so do they. But that doesn't mean that they're not willing to stab each other in the back for advantage in the boardroom. Right? They're all jostling for position in this. So what are the pillars of this global governance thing that they are rolling out? What is the same in China, in Russia, in the US, in the UK, in Germany? What is the same? So the same things are central bank digital currency or digital currency. Now there is some sleight of hand going on in the US at the moment with digital currency, because the US are openly hostile to CBDC. So they're going down the commercial bank digital currency route, but it's the same thing. We've got SDGs. This is really key, I think. Sustainable development is really where it's at, because that brings everything together. So sustainable development is the mechanism by which global governance will exert its authority over every country, because everybody has to commit to sustainable development goals, which I would add have got absolutely nothing to do with climate change. Climate change is just the fairy tale we are given to justify sustainable development. Sustainable development is a policy platform that covers every aspect of our lives, from quote unquote financial inclusion and financial stability, which of course will require digital currency, digital ID. That we're all going to be on some sort of universal digital ID ledger. These are core tenets of sustainable development. Russia and China and India and the US and the EU and most African states are all equally on board with it. There is no dissent from that agenda. Now, of course, that means that it is centrally controlled. You can't have every nation in the world following the same policy platforms without centralized control. The argument that you can is absurd. It's absurd. So of course there's centralized control. So these are the pillars that they're putting in place that everybody is on board with. So going to your question about what are the psyops that they're using and the control mechanisms that they're using to cajole us into accepting all this stuff, and you're talking about future narratives that they might enforce upon us, I would say those narratives are already here. The notion that the planet is boiling, right? That we are told the planet is boiling. Now, if you actually dig into the data and dig into the statistics on what is actually going on with the climate, it's nothing, to be frank. It's nothing. There isn't any kind of unprecedented notable change. We're going through a warming period, a quite normal warming period, which of course makes sense because we've just come out of a mini ice age. So of course we're going through a warming period. The whole thing is a complete fabrication. It's complete garbage. And it goes back to the think tanks again. We've got these centralized global think tanks, perhaps most notably in terms of the climate change narrative, the Club of Rome. So these globalist think tanks create these policy ideas and platforms and agendas that then gets filtered down through what I call the policy distributors, which are people like the IPCC or the World Bank or the IMF, who then use various mechanisms of exploitation and control to garner policy commitments from target nations in exchange, for example, in the IMF's case, in exchange for money. And then those policy commitments get converted into legislation and policy at the national level, and then they get imposed on the people. So this mechanism, this mechanism is global. Everyone's on board with it. Nobody is dissenting from it. I think that's the key thing.
Global bribery network, right? Because
like
Lukashenko, he said that people from the World Health Organization showed up in his country with suitcases full of money and started just trying to bribe people. And he said, I don't want your money. And hey, Belarus didn't shut down. But he did have to experience an attempted color revolution in 2019. So 19, and I think it was in 1920. I think it was December. Anyway, so he did have to go through a turbulence because of that. But yeah, he said, hey, they showed up, they tried to bribe me. And it's like, you wonder how many other decisions are made basically using this global network of bribery. They just say, we want you to implement this environmental policy, this SDG. We want you to start making bug meat or import bug meat or ban cows or something like that. And what do? They just bribe the politicians. And it's like, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out why they're all speaking the same language, talk about the same thing. They go to these conferences. I assume this is how it works. They go to Bilderberg or they go to wherever. They go to the Davos, and people with...
Or summer Davos in China.
Yeah, and people with virtual suitcases full of money or real suitcases full of money, I don't know, they say, hey, take this money and implement this policy, and they do that. I mean, that seems to me like the most obvious mechanism to explain what's going on here. And they're just trying to sort of institutionalize it. Like in America, in America, a lot of the stuff that's mundane and routine for politics would be considered like corruption in Russia. So like lobbying in general, the way it's done in America. So wait, you're telling me that rich people and corporations can give money to politicians to get them to vote? Isn't that corruption? It's like, no, that's democracy. That's how we do it, you know? So they're trying to institutionalize it. They're trying to streamline it, I think. They're trying to make it okay. They're going to make it seem like, oh, it's a good thing. We're saving the world. Some fancy buzzword. Is that it? Am I oversimplifying it? What do you think?
No, not at all. I think you're probably right. I mean, it's very difficult to nail down clear incidents of where that offer of money direct to a politician, you know, where you can really nail it down. I think Lukashenko is a good example of someone that has openly discussed about how this mechanism works. I think we can look throughout the COVID thing. We could look at someone like John Magufuli from Tanzanian government, I think most people probably consider that he was assassinated for demonstrating that the COVID. I mean, he sent off samples of RT-PCR sampled quote unquote COVID tests, which he'd taken from a pawpaw, some engine oil, and a goat. And sent that off to his own laboratory, which was run by the World Health Organization, to test for COVID. They all came back positive. And he sacked the head of his... Now, Magufuli also, it should be pointed out, was a trained chemist. He was a qualified PhD chemist, so he knew what he was talking about. And he pointed this out, that that he'd just got a positive test result from engine oil, sacked the head of his national laboratory, and lo and behold, disappeared off the face of the planet. And then we were told that he died a few months later. And they put someone in his place who was very open to invite the World Health Organization in to help with Tanzania's COVID policy response. So, I mean, that's, you know, they'll kill you. I mean, that's basically what that boils down to. I mean, we're talking about an elected leader of a democratically elected leader of a government who just vanished and disappeared. He wasn't the only African leader, actually, I'll point out. I can't remember the leader's name, but I think he was from Burundi. Very, very similar circumstances. We might look at a few other African leaders where that happened. So I often think of it just simply as a global sort of mafia, really. I mean, I think that's a reasonable analogy. And it's just a mafia type system. They're like the ultimate mafia.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's all it is. Gangsters.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
No, you carry on.
Oh, well, I was just going to add that, not to get too far into the COVID thing, but the inventor of the PCR test, I forgot his name. I didn't think we'd bring it up today, but I watched his old videos, and he also, I think he passed away like right before COVID hit. And he was giving presentations explaining that you can make the test say anything that you want by just changing the parameters. So he was like explaining how you have these cycles, and basically if you crank up the number of cycles, you can find anything. On some level, I mean, yeah, they it seems like we're beating a horse to death here, but you know, apart from our small circle of people who really know that it's all bullshit and understand what's really at stake, I think a lot of people did go along with it because they fell for the fear-based mind programming. So fear was definitely used. And I wonder if they might use other, like, you know, other psychological techniques to get people on board, you know, because the thing is, I don't think you can keep fear going for more than 2 years. It seems to peter out and then they have to swap it out for something. Have you noticed there's these, like, these 2 year cycles? So we're coming up to the end.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very noticeable with the COVID thing. It's run its legs, hasn't it? I mean, if we look at the vaccine uptake in places like the US, it's currently standing at something like 12%.
Right.
So people are just not taking it anymore. Then, you know, that shows. I mean, and I am very suspicious of the figures on vaccine uptake anyway. One thing that struck me that was very interesting that made me kind of think about how much kind of bullshit we're given about these things. So I don't know whether you saw it, but some guy heckled Novak Djokovic at the Australian Open. So some guy shouts out, get the bloody vaccine, right, or something. Now, you know, and obviously he responded by firing an ace, which I thought was, you know, speaks as much, you know, was a fantastic reply. But what I did notice was the way that the crowd rounded on the guy that said that, the booing. Now, that seems to be coming from a sizable proportion of the crowd were booing him.
Yeah.
You know, which made me wonder.
I see what you're getting at. I'm thinking the same thing, too. Like, it would be conducive to their interest for them to portray themselves as the vast majority and us as, like, a beleaguered minority.
Yeah.
But on some level, I guess it depends on what period of time we're talking about. So with this, with the war hoax, which I see is very similar to the COVID hoax, I am starting to see people starting to ask questions now, starting to sort of, it's more of just like a general apathy where they were promised like a resounding victory against Satanism or a resounding victory in the name of democracy. And both sides are realizing that maybe they won't ever openly state it, but, you know, they are getting a little bit worn out by these, by the triumphalism and the outrage and the, like, you know, there aren't there. When this thing started, everyone in America in the big cities were flying Ukrainian flags, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the thing. And now there are no Ukrainian flags, and they moved on to Gaza anyway. So that's why I think they are winding it down, and that's why I think there might be negotiations come springtime. And I think I understand how it's going to look. But I was just thinking in terms of what they're going to do and how they accomplish it. It's actually, if you had any doubts about whether these guys are the good guys or whether they're up to something that's good, why is it that they have to rely on the basest human emotions to affect their agenda? They're always appealing to fear, to terror, to ostracization, to mob tactics. You know what I mean? Like, it's, even if you believed in some of this stuff, if you believed in the cause of globalism because you thought like it would lead to peace, multipolarism because these blocs would have more, I don't know, bargaining power against Washington, why are the methods that they're using even now so suspicious? You know what I mean? Why are they silencing all debate of it?
Well, I think, you know, silencing debate is the point because they don't want you to think rationally about this. This is a kind of key part of behavioral control. Now, I'm fortunate to have a background in working with behavioral change. So I've, you know, I worked for many years with substance misusers, drug and alcohol misusers. And I was part of a program that was using behavioral change positively to help people change what were for them very dangerous and potentially life-threatening behaviors. So you focus on that by being aware of your immediate circumstances, being aware of your thoughts, your feelings, and your emotions in order to be able to take control of them and use them positively in order to end, you know, for example, an addictive behavior. So that's how behavioral change psychology and what they call behavioral psychology. That's how it can be used in a positive way. So it's very much done in participation with the patient. But behavioral psychology can also be used without the patient's knowledge, in which case it becomes a very dangerous system of abuse. And we saw that in COVID, for example, in the UK. We had a behavioral insights team called SpyB who issued a document in which they said, use the media to increase the sense of personal threat. This was advice that was given to the government by them. And that's exactly what the government did. All these media campaigns terrifying people into believing that this cold was some sort of plague. Now, that was using behavioral psychology, because you're introducing a highly emotive and emotionally destabilizing concept into people's minds, which they might find frightening or they might find confusing. The idea is to introduce instability into their thought processes, because there's a document that was accompanied that, a document called Mindspace, in which the government said, and the British government has now got this thing called the Nudge Unit, which it has farmed out all over the world, or the Behavioural Insights Team, that the idea was to move the individual from the position of rational thought to becoming what they call an automated decision maker. Now, that is being applied at the global level by organizations called like the UN in regard to things like climate change. So they tell you ridiculous things like the planet is boiling. You know, whenever there's a heat wave, they say this is evidence of the end of the world. Now, that is exactly what they're using. They're using behavioral psychology to put people into states of fear or states of confusion, into a chaotic mindset, so they can then introduce the solution, which is whatever policy they want you to adopt. This is how it works globally. This is what they're doing.
It's like torture. Like they induce
it is torture,
and then they offer you a way out by complying with what the torturer wants you to do.
Yeah, and so with regard to war, now you started this podcast by saying this is going to be the most depressing podcast you've ever heard. So let me fulfill that.
Go for it.
Right. I strongly believe that they have been talking about a concept called hybrid war. The Russians have been openly discussing this for years. In fact, I think it might even have started with the Soviet Union. I'm not sure about that. I might be wrong about that. But this concept of the hybrid war. Right. So the hybrid war is there's no distinction between war and peace. All is war. Right. So the media is war. All information is war. Policy interfering. So, you know, interfering in another nation's policy is war. Interfering in another nation's economy is war. So economics becomes war. All policy becomes war. And I think you can also introduce to that the obvious things like an expanded war on terror. I think what we're going to see is, I think COVID was very much a trial run. I think what we're going to see moving into the future is war itself become an intrinsic part of our everyday lives. Everything will be war of some ilk, and everything will be related to conflict and war. There will be skirmishes around the world. Undoubtedly, people will be killed, and they will call that World War III. But it is no more real than COVID. And I genuinely believe that's where we're going. I think they're going to, these skirmishes, conflicts, regional conflicts, they're going to spring up. I mean, we can certainly look to the Sahel region of Africa, I think, is an interesting region to look at in terms of that. We're already seeing, obviously, you know, Russian involvement in many countries in Africa in terms of security. The EU has openly said that it considers the Sahel to be its southern neighborhood. So I, and the EU have certainly got military aspirations, a unified European military. So I think that's where we could be heading. We could be heading for, I'm afraid to say, a lengthy period of conflict that they will call World War III, but is actually a managed, constructed system of hybrid war.
So you think that they do that because they like the measures that they can put into place, because it justifies, for example, mass surveillance. There's a video of these new spare bank schools in Russia where the bank operates these schools for children, and they have to do like backpack checks. They have to do mandatory face scans. It's like it's like a prison type system where they're trying to inculcate. So, and the idea is obviously as they grow up, these behaviors will be ingrained and they'll be used to them. So they won't object to it when you know the police or the private police tells them to do these sorts of things as they're older. I think that's the whole point. But is that basically it, that if you have a state of war, a war against terror, a war against Nazism, a war against some phantom threat somewhere, that you can just fuck with people? Like, I don't know. is that the main motivation?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's what Giorgio Agamben spoke about, this idea of the notion of the state of exception or the state of permanent exception. So everything is an extreme threat. Everything's an extreme threat. The weather's an extreme threat. You know, cyber security is an extreme threat. Somebody expressing the wrong opinion online is an extreme threat. Everything's an extreme threat.
Have you heard this theory that it's going to be some sort of cyber event that comes next, and this will justify the shutdown of free speech in the name of securing the internet? That's a theory I've heard floating around for about a year now.
I mean the cyber polygon events, which I would add, Russia's been heavily involved with the cyber polygon events over the years. It's constantly war gaming. A cyber shutdown of the internet or some sort of massive, the notion of cyber warfare, it is so, by its very nature, you can make any claim you like, can't you, with cyber warfare? It's almost, you need a team of forensic cyber analysis to figure out even what's happened, let alone whether to put any kind of plausible attribution of guilt on it. But they can just say whatever they like. If the Wall Street Bank decides that it wants to sabotage its own financial system and then turn around and blame Russia, it can do that. It's easy, isn't it? There's no problem.
Right. Yeah. So that's a good point.
So you can't. I think this is what they're hoping to do, because it all comes back to behavioral control of us. So if you look at, sustainable development, ultimately this is heading us in the 21st century along the path to Agenda 21. And it is very clear in Agenda 21 that what they want humanity to end up is living in what they call human settlements. So they want us living in human settlements. So if we look at what they're currently building in Saudi Arabia, that thing, the line, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Right. Gnome or whatever it is. I mean, they're selling it like it's going to be some sort of utopia. It doesn't look like a utopia to me. It looks like a big prison to me. That's a human settlement. That's what.
So what do you make of these things? Like, why do they want people like live in these human settlements? What's the benefit for them?
Well, I think, if you look at Agenda 21, it talks about two things. It talks about many things, but the two things that stick out: human settlements and protected areas. So you've got protected areas where you will need a license to be able to access those areas. So presumably that'll be the rather more pleasant countryside and the rather more, the nicer parts of the planet. And then these kind of human settlements, which I think will probably turn out to be something like mega cities, where everyone is surveilled, everyone is controlled. So it basically boils down, if you think that what is potentially that represents, it's kind of really kind of the embodiment of eugenics.
You're saying that there will basically be these hive cities and it'll be totally like a prison type, 15-minute prison, surveilled, and probably the density will lend itself to social engineering as well, because it'll be, you know, they'll have greater access to you, I suppose, and then the countryside will be kept fallow for the elite or something like that, sort of like an aristocrat.
For the privileged few. Obviously that's like something that's some sort of crazy dystopian kind of, you know, future.
I buy it.
I don't think it will necessarily be that extreme, but I think it will be something along those lines. Yeah. I mean, we're already seeing it, aren't we? I mean, it's not as if that isn't happening already. So it will be something like that. Yeah. And I think one of the perhaps more alarming things that we might consider is that throughout human history, the ruling elite have always needed our labor, right? So our labor has been important to them. We pay taxes, which enriches them, and they get the fruits of our labor. Well, in a modern technological society where goods and can be manufactured, automated society, where AI can do much of the decision making in terms of, manufacturing goods and manufacturing or even things like farming and so forth, automated farms, that kind of thing. We're not really necessary. We're not really needed that much anymore. So I don't think a depopulation agenda is too far from the truth either. And if we look at the Sorry. Impact of things like male fertility around the world, the way that male fertility is collapsing around the world, we've got an aging population. The idea that, you know, the basic idea that the population itself presents some sort of threat is a lie. That is totally false. If you look at take India, for example, the population's doubled from 600 million to 1.2, 1.3 billion, more than doubled in the space of about half a century. Yet by every single measure, everything has improved in India. Productivity's gone up, educational standards have gone up, income's gone up. So the idea that a rapidly increasing population makes the situation worse is patently false. That's not true, and it's the same.
About the depopulation thing that needs to be better explained is, it seems like certain countries have been slated for depopulation. Other countries actually are producing like 12 kids, 8 kids, like a lot of Africa, for example, and that's all subsidized by these UN organizations. So it seems like they are actually encouraging fertility in some places and discouraging it in more developed places. But I wanted to go somewhere, which I have no idea what your background is on this. It's a little bit out there. But what if there's like a, you know, maybe like a metaphysical or like an occult type motivation to some of the things that are being presented? I'm not the only one who's noticed that, you know, that there are religious texts which might be being referenced here that seem kind of similar to these plans. And maybe on just like some level, they triggering suffering and cognitive dissonance and tearing families apart because you foolishly sent your daughter off to college and then she comes back on Thanksgiving and she hates you and thinks you're a colonizer and doesn't want to celebrate Thanksgiving Day. You know, like there's a lot of these things, they seem to be aimed at increasing human misery, you know, castrating children, just the vile pornography that's constantly being promoted for free and distributed. You go down the list and it's just this really, really, oh, it's just pure nastiness. Perhaps, you know, maybe they're doing it on like a level that's not explainable just through economics or, you know, just political processes. Maybe there's like legit an element of evil here where they're actively trying to make things worse because maybe they, I don't know. What do you think about that? If you don't believe in that, that's fine. But I figured I'd throw it to you. I've seen the things I've seen over the last couple of years have really made me consider this possibility. So I throw it over to you. What do you think of this?
Yeah, I think the occult's an interesting aspect to look at. I mean, certainly if we consider what does the occult mean? It just means, you know, hidden from the ocular, hidden from the eye. It's hidden knowledge. Now, I think there is a lot of hidden knowledge. Undoubtedly, there's a lot of hidden knowledge. I mean, I've always been interested in the work, for example, of Nikola Tesla. I think a lot of his work has been hidden knowledge. I'm quite interested in the notion of put forward by Dr. Judy Woods that advanced technology was used during 9/11. I'm not saying that I necessarily believe that she's entirely correct about that, but I think there is a lot of knowledge that has been hidden from the general population. I was very interested in a Russian-based idea of abiotic oil. You know, the oil is not a fossil fuel at all. So these kind of things, these are the, I think, part of what people might call the occult that interests me particularly. I don't, in terms of secret societies and so forth, I clearly, you know, you look at some of the ritualistic behavior of people like the Skull and Bones and so forth, then it does seem to suggest that there is some sort of occultic ritualistic element to these kind of elite gatherings. Personally, I don't think that it is a major driver of what they're doing. And I doubt whether all of them are on board with some sort of kind of worship of Saturn or something like that.
The one I go for. Yeah, I think there's something satanic about all this. But
I mean, I think there's definitely plenty of evidence to suggest that some of them do worship Saturn. You know, that there's no doubt about that. I mean, one thing that I would also say that there's a lot of evidence for, which people never talk about, is satanic ritual abuse. So as in not as in Saturn, but as in Satan, satanic ritual abuse happens. It's a well-known fact that it happens. That people have been prosecuted for it all over the world. People have been prosecuted for satanic ritual abuse in nearly every country on earth. I mean, especially if we look at something like what happened in Belgium with, I forget the name of the case now. But I mean, you know, this went to the very height of the Belgian establishment. So there's no doubt that this and that. What does that mean when we're talking about ritual child sacrifice? That's what that means. That's what that boils down to. So, but personally, I don't think, you know, I it's not something that I know enough about to speak about with any authority for a start. But it's not something that I think is a primary driver for what I call the global public-private partnership. I think that is based very much upon realpolitik, money, economics, geopolitics, and kind of the pursuit, relentless pursuit of global power. You know, and I think probably the occult part, for me, to the extent that the occult part of it exists, it exists within that. And I don't think it's a driver of that.
Yeah, you know, the ritual abuse stuff. I mean, that's exactly how I would characterize what they're doing to us with this propaganda. I mean, it's torn families apart. I mean, you know, I see it on a very visceral, close level because of the Ukraine thing. So it's like an unwanted intruder in the home, and this intruder has come. And he's set, you know, brother against brother, father against son. You know, it's set a whole country against each other to tear itself at the seams. And the methods that they use, I think, are occultic. I think they're Kabbalic. They're based in the. I mean, I think that a lot of this occult stuff is just forgotten or poorly understood technology, in the sense that you read this stuff and you're like, oh, this is like psychology. They're explaining psychological manipulation techniques. These rituals are just experiment procedures, you could say. So that's sort of one of the insights or the things I've started believing in recent years. And I do think there is a religious element personally. I do think that there is this end times scenario that they're trying to push, I think a lot of this, like, for example, the global warming stuff, if you really look into it, you might be able to trace it back to Jesuit prophetic texts from the turn of the century, where they talk about a burning world, and they talk about a lot of this sort of stuff. And then all of a sudden, I do think there are examples of a lot of this stuff in, say, Kabbalah that yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, what I do think perhaps that they were inspired by it. And
I think it's fair to say that there are archetypal narratives that work, and that may be part of occult hidden knowledge is how to use those archetypal narratives, because they emerge throughout history. So the notion of the end times, you can go back thousands of years to the Sumerian texts talking about the end times, the Aztecs, more or less any kind of successful large culture has had these archetypal narratives running through it. They're repetitive. And for I sure. think, and I think that, the modern climate disaster narrative is no different in that regard. It's
that we've angered the weather gods, and we have to do these irrational cultic things to fix the weather. I mean, that's what it is. And they even dress up as like you've seen those protests, Extinction Rebellion protests. Extinction Rebellion, which is financed, I forget his name, connected wealthy billionaires financing these groups. And how do they dress up? They dress up as these like bizarre priests from like some futuristic scenario. And it's like, oh, some people will justify it by saying, they're just trying to get attention. But like, okay, well, there's always a justification. I see what I see, and I'm starting to make connections.
That's the Gettys. The Getty family is backing groups like Just Stop Oil in the UK. So, I mean, the irony is, we're talking about one of the richest oligarch families in human history. Funding an organization like Just Stop Oil. Extinction Rebellion, they're funded by, I can't remember the name of the... Well, they're funded by a very wealthy British billionaire as well, who runs an organization that raises money for... His investment vehicle invests exclusively in what we might call social disruption. So socially disruptive causes. So why would a billionaire who attends places like Davos and the Bilderberg Group and so forth, why would they be investing? Like, I'll put down that this is all tax deductible, of course, because it's through his foundation, so it's a tax write-off. So there's that reason for a start. But beyond that, why would they invest in these so-called disruptive causes? Clearly it suits their purposes, it suits their agenda. So then we need to find out, we need to understand what that agenda is. And in my view, that agenda is globalist, and it's to break down what we currently have in terms of any kind of semblance of global quote unquote order, which I would argue is a ridiculous concept in the first place, but anyway, and to introduce a new one that better suits their interests.
One last thing I'll throw to you. I've noticed when I was working, for example, in like Kazakhstan, I was in the media, and Kazakhstan, I was talking about this on Geopolitics and Empire. It's an episode, it's going to come out soon, and the host also worked in Kazakhstan, and we were both remarking on how, like, probably because of Borat or something, people think of it as this traditional conservative country, and in many ways the average person is, but the government is pursuing this like incredibly heavy-handed, top-down, digitalized, technology-based social reform agenda, like creating just full bore, like all this stuff. It's going overboard in Kazakhstan, like really over the top, and we both know that that's happening because we both experienced working there and the propaganda that they're putting out. Anyway, the main thing is that connected to all this, it's the empowerment of women. So a lot of the loans that these guys are getting from Western organization, globalist organizations, stipulate that, say, 30% of the government has to be women. Cabinets has to have, they have to be quotas for women. So much money needs to go to women. All this stuff about empowering women, women, women. And I think it's because, and then you look at the hysteria, and in Ukraine, who are the people who are the most bloodthirsty and, like, just, you know, over the top with their craziness? It's the women. So I see that. I think feminism is a very important part of this. How do you destroy the fertility rates? You empower the women. You just go down the list, and it's like the women thing is one of the key mechanisms, I think, that they're using to promote this. And I'm not saying all women. I'm sure there's a few women who aren't like this. I'm just saying that the vast majority seem, for some, I'm just saying that the globalists, for some reason, seem to think that by empowering them and turning them against men, you know, getting them involved in politics, that this will further their ends. It's kind of a touchy subject, but I brought it up with my last two guests. Up to you. Do you want to take it, or?
Yeah, I'll take that.
Okay.
I think that, you know, what they do is that they take something which has got an authentic and justifiable political position, such as the kind of feminism that we saw. You know, you can almost go all the way back to, you know, women getting the vote, right? The notion that women should be equal citizens in all respects, which was the basis of, you know, Germaine Greer type feminism, right? It's the notion that women deserve to have an equal voice in the kind of political, in all aspects of our society, which they didn't have for, you know, most of human history. So that's that. And I would say that you could apply the same for gay rights. So for gay people, you know, there was a period where they were actually imprisoned for being gay. So they had an authentic political struggle, which many people, myself included, would support, right? But then those political movements which have a reasonable foundation, and I would suggest a strong argument, are then usurped and infiltrated. And those of us in the alternative media need to be acutely aware of this, because it doesn't just stop at political movements. They're infiltrated and usurped and turned into something else. So
have you heard of the theory of bio-Leninism? Because it sounds like we're zeroing in on that. It's this idea that you take a grieved, grievance groups, and you give them political power because you know that they will punish, they will be loyal and they will be sadistic and they will punish, like, the people that have aggrieved them. So if you give it to homosexuals who have a grudge against everybody else in society, you know that you're going to have a very loyal enforcer of whatever draconian policy. You take a spurned woman who's, like, in her late 30s, who you know, didn't, whatever, she's, something went wrong, you empower her, and she's going to really take it out on young men, for example. So that's kind of the theory that you want to empower the dregs of society, criminals, people with no conscience whatsoever, because you can count on them to make things worse, and you can count on their loyalty, because without you giving them that job and that ideology and a place in that worldview and allowing them to make war on good people, normal people, they're nothing. So they're dependent on you. A strong, independent man is capable. You know, he's not that interested in, say, working for the government or being a bureaucrat, right? Because, yeah. Well, I mean, so that's one theory. Well, but
yeah, no, that's an interesting theory. And I could say you could turn that to the political class, couldn't you? And say, because I think we're ruled by a kakistocracy. They've taken the worst of the worst and empowered them. You know, that's, but I mean, I think that you can also look out throughout history and see that same pattern repeating. You know, if you look at the aristocracies of old, these inbred kind of thick as two short planks, ne'er-do-wells who have got ultimate political authority. You know, that's not new, I would suggest, in that regard. But going back to the point about, for example, you know, gay rights, for example, so there's a political struggle, right? So there's a political struggle for genuine equality under the law, which is a reasonable thing, I think, for gay people to fight for. But then that gets mutated into the trans agenda, which has got everything to do with transhumanism. It's got nothing to do with gay rights. And interestingly enough, a lot of the strongest criticisms against the transhumanist and the transgender agenda in the West at the moment are coming from many prominent prominent gay rights activists who was, you know, arguing that, you know, what we were seeking was not this. That the gay rights argument was never that the heterosexual family life should be destroyed. That was never part of their argument. Their only argument was that we should have the same rights to live a decent quality of family life as a gay family.
In Russia, in the Soviet Union, they pursued like radical feminism and homosexuality as well. And they were actually really explicit about it. This woman, I forget her name, she was one of the top reformers, and she would like have orgies and stuff. And she wrote it out. She was like, the reason why we're empowering women and gays is to destroy the family and to destroy marriage. Yeah. And so in some places they were pretty explicit about it. But I get what you're saying. There's definitely different kinds. You mentioned transhumanism. Let's touch on that as the last topic, because I know very little about this WEF style transhumanism. What are we talking about here? Like, are we talking about cyborg, like, you know, sticking guns in your arm, or are we talking about sort of Brave New World being able to from birth and like make people worse off, or like make them more slavish or something? Or are we talking what are we talking about? Transhuman? Are we talking like a philosophical type thing? I know that the head advocate of this transhumanist idea is this guy who wrote a book called Sapiens. He's an Israeli guy who's being promoted now. I forget his name. Am I on the right track? Can you explain that? Yeah, him. Am I on the right track? Yeah. Can you explain what we're dealing with here? Is because I don't think it's like in my video games, like cyberpunk, where I can, you know, take a blade out of my forearm and it looks really cool. That's not what they're talking about. No.
No. What they're talking about is the integration of the human mind with technology. And, you know, I mean, there are people like Eric Schmidt, you know, the former head and founder of Google, who, you know, is seriously talking about defeating death. So the idea would be that you would upload your consciousness to the cloud, and that therefore you would exist as a consciousness in some sort of disembodied form, or your consciousness could be put into an artificial body. That kind of thing. I mean, the Great Reset, which is comical in many respects, if you ever get the chance to read it, is full of this kind of lunacy. I mean, they're offering a synthetic future as some sort of utopia, which going back to what you were saying much earlier in the conversation about the conflict between good and evil. I think it can be absolutely described as that, and it can be, and it's most observable actually if we see what the transhumanist agenda is actually about. Because I would strongly argue, I'm not religious in any way, but I do consider myself to be a spiritual being. I know that sounds like a contradiction, but I do understand that there is more to my consciousness than merely my physical form. I'm not just some meat slab. You know, the fact that, you know, for example...
Yeah, I agree. I didn't want to go there. I didn't want to, like... but now that you broached it, I'm thinking maybe there is an element of spiritual warfare going on here where they're trying to mutilate the spirit.
So they're trying to take away everything that is humanity. So the humanity, the beauty that we find in the world around us, the beauty that we find in each other, the love that we experience... Even the anger and the hate that we experience, the things that make us human, that make us, you know, that put us in touch with our natural world that we are part of. And I, you know, and some of us would go as far to argue a universe that we are part of. They're trying to separate us from that and put us into a synthetic universe, the metaverse, that they control. So this is almost like saying, it is saying, we are God. God is dead. We are God. We will be your gods. That is, if you boil it down, that is what the I would argue is the ultimate objective of transhumanism. So there's nothing good about that. That is evil. That is the destruction of humanity. It is literally transforming us into something other than humanity. So I would suggest that we are in an existential, and I've said this for a long time, but we are in an existential fight for our survival as a species. And I mean, you know, we are all, it doesn't matter what country we live in, it doesn't matter what flag we wave, it doesn't matter what color we are, what religion we are, none of that makes any difference. We are facing a group of people, and it's a tiny group of people who are hell-bent upon destroying humanity as we know it and creating what they think is a utopia.
They probably think that they're evolving humanity, right? Like that a certain select group will benefit. Like they're trying to do the transhumanism stuff on themselves. It's like the rest of us will just be peons in a polluted hive city, right? They will have digital consciousness, digital transfers. They'll create maybe like a collective unconsciousness, like a group egregore, maybe they'll do... You know, a lot of the stuff about AI, I mean, again, I think it's just pure Kabbalah, because what they're saying is that it doesn't even make sense what they're talking about. Like, how do you create a living intellect out of nothing, out of circuitry? And this one guy explains it. His name is Nick Land, and he's like a neo-Marxist, like
the dark Kabbalist.
Yeah, but he's. So he talks about like how it's basically. What you're doing is you're summoning like a demon from the warp or the new sphere, and you're trapping it in the sigils and the glyphs that are the circuitry, the circuit board. Actually, they look like circuits and glyphs. If you zoom out, they look like ancient seals or mandalas or whatever. And so he's basically saying like, well, let's be consistent here. You can't create an intellect out of nothing. You're basically summoning it down. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if any of that's real. But it wouldn't surprise me. He's connected. It wouldn't, and he's, you know, friends with all these Silicon Valley type people. So he's friends with Peter Thiel. It wouldn't surprise me if that's what they believe and that's what they're trying to do. My whole concern is like if they can do whatever they want with themselves, whatever. But what element of the transhuman agenda are they forcing on us? I can see that they're trying to chemically castrate the children with the gender reassignment surgeries. Is there another element of the transhumanist agenda that they're forcing on us, not just reserving for themselves, the elite?
Yeah, our entrance into the metaverse. So our reliance upon digital technology, you know, we've already, I mean, people more or less have got cell phones grafted into their hands already, haven't they? I mean, I walk around my local community and it just amazes me that kids don't get run over more often because they're just constantly walking along the street looking at a screen. You know, this notion of melding us with technology, that's the game. And I don't think that is necessarily reserved for the elite, but I think the nature in which we are melded with technology is probably different for the elite. I mean, they are seriously people like Schmidt and Thiel. And interestingly about Nick Land put forward, he wrote a thing called The Dark Enlightenment, which was very much inspired by his work with Peter Thiel. And that leads into a concept called accelerationism.
You know your stuff.
Yeah. So accelerationism is everywhere. It's everywhere. So if you look at, for example, the WEFS agreement with the United Nations, the WEFS agreement, the text of that agreement reads that they agree to accelerate the world towards sustainable development goals. Every time you see when they're talking about some sort of major policy shift, they want to accelerate change. Now, Until I was aware of Land and the Dark Enlightenment and so forth, I always, like most people, you read these things, you see the word accelerate, and you take it as literally just meaning to speed up the process. That's as far as we take it. Because that's what we think the words mean. It's almost like another language. It's like legalese. It's like another language.
Yeah, that's like not what, they misuse words. Like, what does the proletariat mean? What are they really talking about when they're using these terms? Who are they talking about? You know, Trotsky thought he was a proletariat. He's one of the richest men in Europe and the whole world, you know? Like, he never worked a day in his life in the factory, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
But go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
So this word accelerationism, what Thiel and Land were talking about, and this came out of Warwickshire University, actually, where Land was part of this kind of cyberpunk kind of think tank at Warwickshire University. What they're talking about is a kind of extreme form of Schumpeter's creative destruction. So, you know, Schumpeter's economic idea of creative destruction, i.e. the breakdown, which goes to the very thing that we were talking about at the beginning of this discussion, about the breakdown of economic structures so that they can be rebuilt in a more efficient manner, right? Now, so Land took Schumpeter's creative destruction idea, and with Thiel built this notion of applying that to nearly all social and political structures. So they called that accelerationism, and they expressed that through a very convoluted thesis called the Dark Enlightenment. Now, that is absolutely, once you understand it and you see that that is what they're, and they were talking about building something called, I can't remember what the name they gave it. I think they called it it wasn't Globo Cap. Was it Globo Cap? Globo Core, right? So they wanted to build this thing called Globo Core. So a global corporate entity. Because they argued that it was private business and it was private entrepreneurs and it was private innovation that really should be ruling the world, because that was where all kind of decent ideas came from. And that the political structures were just nonsense that was getting in the way. And they particularly despised democracy. They thought democracy was a terrible idea. So that is accelerationism, and that is manifest in everything you read that's coming out of places like the WEF and, you know, Chinese Central.
So the accelerationism part, are they trying to destroy something by increasing the contradictions in it? It's been a while since I've read Land and Moldbug and these people. Are they trying to say, like, if there's a problem, you should add gas to the fire and make it basically destroy itself, so that in the chaos something new can emerge? Is that about it?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah, they're just the idea of, but it's also
Lenin. That's just straight up Lenin.
Yeah, like, and that, I mean, it's also the idea of accelerating the pace of change, which they felt was something that technology lent itself, you know, specifically digital technology lent itself to very well, because what Land noted was the pace at which computing power was advancing, because computing power was he noticed and through Moldbug, they noted that although I think Moldbug was Land, wasn't it? Wasn't that his alter ego? I can't remember.
No, Moldbug is actually on Tucker Carlson now. His name is Curtis Yarvin, and
that's it, Curtis Yarvin. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Who Thiel gave him the seed money for his company, didn't he? He gave Yarvin the seed money.
Oh, Thiel runs this whole section of the so-called, the alt-right, dissident right. It's all Thiel money. And they promote these ideas as if they were sort of like traditional or right-wing. It's quite bizarre, because they're basically arguing for neo-feudalism. Yeah. And they're coming up with justifications for it. And I had a lot of people who are really fed up with the current system, who are right-leaning maybe by their nature, have gotten unfortunately swallowed up by this cult. And they're really vocal and active. And unfortunately, I've clashed with them before. And they have another guy, Bronze Age Pervert, who's a big name in those circles. And if you like really look at their ideas, they're extremely left-wing. Like, not left-wing, like, I mean, progressive. Very, for example, they worship Nietzsche. And Nietzsche was banned in National Socialist Germany. But what does Nietzsche advocate for? Basically, Dionysian creative destruction, unleashing massive changes, justifying the power of the elite, might makes right, you know, all this stuff to justify.
Well, the twilight of the idols, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's a lot that you could say and about Nietzsche, and I really despise everything he has to say. I've really studied his stuff, and I have a hatred for him that only someone who like used to like him and then realized what it was really all about, that, you know, that kind of a hatred, like a betrayal type thing. You read some of his letters and what he's like really trying to get at. He's trying to justify the emergence of this new power elite that we're talking, that we've been talking about for this entire podcast. And he's trying to give them, you know, that's it. That's what all these philosophers, they're all just propagandists. They're all just trying to justify one faction or another and their claim to power. And so with these people, they claim this is the new aristocracy, and aristocracy is good. And it should be Silicon Valley geniuses who run the new neo-feudal system. And lo and behold, they're being paid by these people to say it. I mean, that's just like, it's so textbook. That's literally just paid propaganda. But because and they're not even good writers. I'm sorry, I hate these people so much. And they're not even good writers. Like, you read this, it's nigh indecipherable. And we brought up the occult, and Land doesn't even hide it. He's a Kabbalist. Like, that's his thing. He's a Marxist Kabbalist. And yet, he has a place on the right. It's just insane. Oh, yeah. Like, yeah.
Well, you get a mirror vision of accelerationism coming from the left through people like what's his name, Mason, the British journalist and sort of political commentator, who wrote a book. You know, because their argument is that whereas Land and Thiel are arguing that the political kind of structures inherent in democratic institutions are essentially, you know, they will eat themselves. They are essentially corrupt and useless as organizations. They're self-defeating, that they will eat themselves and lead us all into some sort of kind of an inevitable moral decay and breakdown of everything. Therefore, let's just get rid of the whole lot and have some sort of elite power structure, because won't that be better? On the left, on the people that call themselves the left, they make the same argument, but from the perspective of climate change. So climate change is the thing that shows the weakness of our existing political and social paradigms, and what we really need is some sort of functioning system of global governance. That will save us from killing ourselves by driving too many cars. You know, they have very much recognized that Thiel and Land and their concept of the Dark Enlightenment is very much associated with the quote unquote right. And so they've gone out of their way to distance themselves from that now, and said that, you know, that there's a fundamental difference between their approach and that of Land and so forth. But there isn't. It's the same idea, but they exactly. just don't. But they're just mired in this left-right paradigm, you see. So for them, that's really important.
They use coded language, like color-coded language, in the sense that like these guys will use left-wing color-coded language, and these guys will use right-wing color-coded language. And that way we'll be able to flank and like get the agenda has to be promoted from all sides, and it's the same group of people, it's the same agenda being promoted by supposedly people who are on opposite ends of the political. It's like we said about, remember the Soviet Union and the economy of Russia? Well, it's strange, you know, like that one had political chiefs that became oligarchs, whereas modern Russia has oligarchs that became political chiefs. It's still converging towards the same thing. They're creating propaganda to justify the ruling class or the emerging ruling paradigm, For a right winger, they appeal to the past, and like, wasn't it nice when there were serfs and you know, these, and the church was lording it over or whatever, and wasn't it nice to the left wing? Wouldn't it be nice if we had this utopia? It's the same thing, and it's kind of scary. You know, there are people who I think are smart. They have at least 130 IQ, and they're listening to this crap and they're nodding along because both sides seem to think that they will be the privileged. They will be the philosopher kings that will rule this future global city state thing. They think they're the ones that are going to be, no, I'm sorry. Like, it's going to be people like Moldbug, like Land and Thiel, yeah. So you're not invited to the party. So stop repeating elite ideologies that are designed to just bamboozle you and to get you to justify your own slavery. I think a lot of people, like with the Russia stuff, the multicolor, let's bring it full circle with the multipolar stuff, you have these people who are justifying or repeating the propaganda of the ruling elite who are trying to effect a bad change. Like, they're trying to make things worse. It's not going to be a better world if they institute these changes. And they're getting peasants and proles to advocate for it because they think that this is about them. They think that they're like serious political players, that they have a say, that these changes are going to make, you know, it's an identity crisis. It's like, listen, man, you are a peasant, you are a prole, you're in the same boat as me. Stop trying to say like, if I support Russia or I support Ukraine or I support China or the BRICS or I support the dark enlightenment, that makes me somehow better than everybody else. You know, we have to have some solidarity here. We have to understand that they're elite-driven agendas. None of them are for our best interests. Almost every single one of these agendas, one thing that they have in common, doesn't matter who it is, it's that they think that there's a lot of useless eaters. Every single one of these progressive revolutionary agendas has started by culling the useless eaters. You look at every revolution, every big progressive change that's occurred over the last 500 years, it starts with culls. It starts with culls of the poles. When in England, when they had the Enclosure Act, when they got rid of the commons and moved into industrialization, there were culls of the peasants who, if they didn't go into the barracks in the city, they were done away with. When the French had the revolution, they were sinking boats full of people down in the rivers to drown them all. They were going into the countryside and culling it. Bolshevik Russia, the culls were there. They're openly saying that, yeah, we're going to have to cull a lot of people for our utopian schemes to work, you know. So wake up, like, you're having an identity crisis. These are not good people. They're not on your side. You're not one of them. Come back to reality, please. Let's just talk facts. And thank you so much for talking facts with me. Do you have any final words? We've been talking for a while. I could talk with you forever about this stuff. But what do you think? Do you have any final thoughts?
No, it's been very interesting. I'd just like to echo what you said. And, you know, really what we have to realize, we as in humanity, us, the normal people, right? We have to realize that there is a class of people who are, and it's a global class, as you just quite rightly pointed out, who are genuinely in opposition to us. We are the 99.99%, and we need to be united against them because they are seeking to control, exploit, and ultimately, you're right, kill us. So, you know, that's what we need to do. And all these divisions, these divisions, you know, and I've fallen foul of them myself within the alternative media circles of people, you know. And one of the things that I think disappoints me most about what's happened recently in terms of the discussion around multipolarity is the mudslinging and the name calling, as if having an open and honest debate about something in open and honest disagreement is a bad thing. That's not a bad thing. That's how traditionally we've always come to new understanding. So, you know, it's very disappointing in that respect. And we
it's the propaganda.
The propaganda.
Yeah, they're ideologized and they won't you can't talk to them. They're gone. Like they see you as the enemy, even though it's like, bro, I'm your neighbor. We're in the same boat. We make the same income. You know, we should probably, you know, be able to have a conversation. We should be able to live with each other, you know. And that's the thing. They want us to not be able to create cohesive communities, work together. They want us at each other's throats for sure. And I'm guilty. When I was younger, I also had very like idealistic convictions. and they did get in the way of being able to converse with people. But now I think my criteria is, are you willing to just examine the facts, or can we just state facts without ideology? I'm not trying to proscribe something. I'm not trying to get you to march under my ideological flag. I just want you to read the facts, you know, like let's look at the stats here. Like, this is what's happening. And then we can, yeah. Anyway, anyway, thank you for talking to me.
My pleasure.
We should definitely do this again. I really enjoyed your debate with Matt Arrett and some other guy when you and Riley were talking on Off Guardian. I think after that, they basically shut it down and they were like, we're not going to have any more debates because...
Seems that way, yes.
Yes. So we're going to do what we can to break out of this blackout, right?
Yeah, they're forging ahead with unity, and they want everybody to be united against the common enemy, as long as you absolutely agree with their perspective on everything.
Yeah. It's people got to get better at being able to tell paid shills, paid propagandists, apart from people asking questions. Like, that's what I hope. All right. That's enough. Thank you again, sir. We have to do this again some other time. Until next time, though.
Yeah. My pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me. I've really enjoyed it.